In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Jai and Aisha were India's golden couple in the mid-20th century, rubbing shoulders with American film stars and British royalty. But while they were enjoying polo and parties, they were also trying to adapt to a rapidly changing post-independence India and carve out a new role for themselves, which led to Aisha's dazzling entry into politics and eventual spell in jail when she fell foul of Prime Minister Indira Gandhi. Our section editor, Rhiannon Davies, spoke to John Zabriskie, author of a new book on the family, The House of Jaipur, about their fascinating history.
So your new book, The House of Jaipur, follows the fortunes of India's most glamorous royal family. Can you briefly sketch out their family tree for us?
Yeah, sure. Look, it's this book really is about two royal houses. The book is titled House of Jaipur, but it's actually about Jaipur, the princely state, and Cooch Behar, which was a much smaller princely state in the east of India, sort of wedged between what is now Bangladesh and Bhutan. Perhaps it'd be good just to give you a little bit of background about the princely states in India in general. There were about 565 of them in pre-independence India, ranging in size from maybe less than an acre with a population of just a couple of hundred to much larger states such as Hyderabad, Kashmir, Baroda, and so on. And these were states. Hyderabad was almost the size of France, had a population around 16 million at the time of independence. Now, in this huge hierarchy of states, the British came up with their typical obsession with categorization, with this system of gun salutes. So about 120 of these states, the largest ones and the most important ones, were given gun salutes, and these ranged from 9 guns to up to 21 guns. And there were only 5 21-gun salutes, Hyderabad, Baroda, Gwalior, Kashmir, and Mysore. So within that range, you have Jaipur, which was a 17-gun salute state, and Cooch Behar, which was a 13-gun salute state. The two main characters in the story, the two main personalities in this book are Gayatri Devi, better known as Aisha, and Sawai Man Singh, better known as Jai. Gayatri Devi came from Cooch Behar, which was the small state in eastern India, and Jai was the Maharaja of Jaipur. So again, Jai was a Rajput, and we can talk about the Rajputs a bit later in this conversation. Whereas Aisha's parents came from Baroda, and she married into the Cooch Behar royal family. And Baroda was one of the more important states in western India, in what is now Gujarat, so a few hundred kilometres north of Bombay or Mumbai, as it is now, and also one of the most progressive states as well in India. So that's something that we'll also probably come back to later in the conversation. That's quite important too, as to how the story unfolds.
And before we come on to their relationship in more detail, I really wanted to hear a bit more about Jai's upbringing and how it is that he actually becomes the Maharaja and the ruler of Jaipur. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. It's very interesting because he actually was born not in Jaipur city. He came from a small Tikana, which I guess the best way to describe that would be like an estate, and located around 80 kilometres from Jaipur. And this small Tikana, which was called Isada, if you go there today, it's hardly changed in, 50, 100 years. You blink and you'll miss it. Now, he was adopted from that Tikana by the then Maharaja of Jaipur, Mado Singh. Now, Mado Singh didn't have an heir. And this was actually quite common among Rajputs. One often thinks of these Indian princes as having these vast harems, multiple wives, concubines and so on, and producing multiple children. As was often the case, there were no legitimate heirs in these states. In other words, the ruler might have cohabited with his concubines rather than with his official wives. And therefore, only a legitimate son of one of the official wives could take over the kingdom. Now, in Mado Singh's case, he was a good, capable ruler, but he was also quite superstitious, and he was told that if he had a legitimate son, that he would die within 6 months. So he stopped basically cohabiting with his official wives and started to look for alternatives for somebody to for a suitable heir. Now, to cut a long story short, he was also adopted from this small Tikana of Isada. So Isada became the official, the obvious choice for him in order to find an heir. And so he invited Jai, whose name then was Mordamukut, along with his brother to the palace to kind of vet them and decide whether they, one of them would make a suitable ruler. And Jai was the one who made the impression on him. Now, this wasn't as straightforward as it sounds, because normally in Jaipur, there were several different Tikanas from which rulers were traditionally adopted or chosen from, and Isada was not one of them. So Jai's adoption was immediately embroiled in controversy. The Tikana, which thought it was its right that somebody from there should be adopted, immediately started petitioning, the Viceroy, the Secretary of State for India, etc., that this was the wrong choice. There was all sorts of intrigue going on behind the scenes to thwart this move. So Jai's coming, Jai's adoption when he was only about 10 years old was mired in controversy. Within 18 months of being formally adopted by Madho Singh, who was actually his uncle, Madho Singh died, and so Jai became not of course not the the ruler, because he was far too young, but he was placed on the throne, on the gadi, if you like, and then a period the British appointed a regency council to rule the state until he came, until he was old enough to rule in his own right.
This is something I wanted to know a bit more about, is how the British controlled him, especially in his formative years.
This is very interesting. Now, the British they exerted power, in fact, through a resident. So the British would appoint a resident in each of the major princely states. And in Jaipur's case, this was, a very important person who had the final say in all sorts of things, whether it was adoption, marriage, exactly the circumstances surrounding Jai's eventual placement on the throne, his education, whether he could travel abroad, all sorts of things were controlled by the British Raj, essentially. Now, they were also had to deal with all the the intrigue that was surrounding his adoption by Madho Singh, to the point where they feared that if he remained in Jaipur, his life might be in danger. They were also concerned about the fact that once he was adopted, and you're talking, as I said, about a boy of 10, 11 years old, he was immediately placed in the zanana, in the harem, and the British were very concerned about that as well, because they thought that this was a corrupting influence on such a young boy to be surrounded by all these women who were going to be pandering and doting on him and so on. So that was another concern. As was the tradition in many of these princely states, and as was the wish of his uncle, the former Maharaja, they also wanted him to marry at a very early age. So Madho Singh had already arranged that the sister and niece of the Maharaja of Jodhpur be married to Jai. And at this point, Jai was only 11 years old. That the sister, Marada Kanwa, was almost twice Jai's age. She was around 22, whereas her niece, Kishore Kumari, was only 5. So, the British wanted to control this. Not only did they think that he was far too young to get married, which was, as we would judge it today, quite true, but also they wanted to even control, and he did marry Marada Kanwa, who became first Her Highness when he was about 13. They were so obsessed about him not sleeping with his wife that they controlled, that they made sure that whenever they were together that there was somebody with them, so they never had any privacy, and so there was this almost overbearing control on the part of the British over Jai's life from the moment he set foot in Jaipur.
And how did Jai feel about the British?
Look, that's a very good question. I think, as a young boy growing up in that environment, he really had no choice but to accept whatever decisions they were going to make on his part. He ended up doing most of his schooling at Mayo College, which was set up specifically for the princes of India, or many of the princes of Rajasthan. And then he had a brief stint at the military academy at Woolwich as well. But I think for most of that early period, until he became a ruler in his own right, he basically had no choice but to go along with whatever the British said. Once he became ruler in his own right, then, you know, he had a little bit more autonomy. You know, he could push against some of what the British had in mind as far as the administration, et cetera, of the state. So the relationship between Britain and princely states like Jaipur were determined by treaties, and under those treaties, the British actually had, they had no right to actually directly intervene in the running of the states. They could dismiss a ruler if the ruler, you know, was particularly despotic or debauched or, you know, too autocratic, and that didn't happen that often, but it did happen. But they tried to sort of set examples and try and enlighten, if you like, the rulers of these states into the, you know, make them aware of the advantages of introducing, say, more representative government or doing something for their state, like encouraging industry and so on. And this is why it was also so important in many of these states that these young rulers were sent off to colleges like Mayo, or even sent abroad to study in Eton or Harrow and so on, to get this, to get a proper education. And again, get them out of the zanana, out of the harem, into the real world, imbue them with modern values that they could then implement when they became rulers in their own right. So with Jai, they were, once he became a ruler in his own right, he did have a bit more autonomy, but that also coincided with, I guess, a lesser interest on his part in actual administration of the state. He would leave it up to his diwan or prime minister to do the day-to-day running of it. And as he quickly found out, and much to the dismay of the British, he ended up spending a lot of time in Europe and on the continent pursuing his favourite pastimes, which were polo and beautiful women. So that's what happened from pretty much once he was in his early 20s onwards.
I definitely wanted to hear a bit more about this from you, because he does seem to be very enamoured with this lifestyle of fast cars and polo ponies, beautiful women. Can you tell us a bit more about his early 20s and what he got up to?
Yeah, well, look, initially it was his love of polo. One advantage of marrying into the royal family of Jodhpur was that he inherited some of the best polo players in India. So in 1933, he assembled a polo team comprised of himself and three players from Jodhpur. And basically, aside from one or two matches at the beginning, won every single match of the polo calendar for that year, and kept on doing that for the rest of the decade until war intervened in 1939. So I'm not an expert on polo, but I think it's safe to say that the Jaipur polo team was, still is, would be considered the best in the world. And polo was one of Jai's enduring passions. In fact, he would die on the polo field in 1970 while playing a match. Of course, so the world of polo introduced him into the world of British aristocracy. And among his among the close relationships that he made through polo was with the Mountbattens, for instance. But also with the landed gentry, the the film set, the the party set, the the very top echelons of British society, were the people that he mixed with. And although he, by then, he was already married to his first two wives, that didn't stop him from having numerous affairs while he was in England. At around about the same time, he'd already met Aisha. She had fallen in love with him when she was after they'd first met, and she was only 13 and he was about 19. She had a child, a schoolgirl crush on him that just intensified over the years. He reciprocated that quite readily. But even while that courtship, which is very romantic, was going on, he was having, high-profile affairs, including with Joan Eyres Monsell, who later married Patrick Leigh Fermor, and a American film actress called Virginia Sherrill, who was the flower girl in Charlie Chaplin's City Lights film. Virginia came to England in the early 30s. She'd been married to Cary Grant. It was a not particularly happy marriage. It was quite an abusive husband, tried to throttle her once, and when she left him, wanted to commit suicide. But she was, partly as a result of her fame as in the Chaplin film, was welcomed into British society, into these higher echelons of British society that Jai also mixed with. And they started a long, long running affair. It went for something like 6 years, and would have stretched probably beyond that had the war not intervened. What's really interesting about that affair was, first, the openness of it, and secondly, that Virginia developed a close relationship with Jai's second wife, Kishore Kumari, whose nickname was Joe Diddy. And Joe was his first wife, Marida Kanwa, was a very traditional woman who, accepted the strictures of purdah without any complaint, whereas Joe Diddy was someone, she was a much more free-spirited woman, and met Virginia when she travelled to England with Jai in about the mid-30s. And the two of them developed a very, very close relationship. And Joe saw Virginia as her passport out of purdah, actually, and urged Virginia to marry Jai. Jai had actually proposed to Virginia, even though he was actively pursuing Aisha at the same time, actually proposed to Virginia to be his third wife, to come to India and live with him. And Joe thought this was going to be fantastic. She didn't mind the fact that he was taking yet another wife, because it would just make her life more interesting, less tradition-bound, and just more fun. Jai didn't marry Virginia. When Virginia did come to Jaipur, she was horrified by what she saw. The tiger hunting, going into these palaces, into the zenanas, and seeing women in purdah, seeing these zenanas with dozens and dozens of concubines from previous maharajas, etc. So she rebuffed Jai's offers of marriage, but the two continue their affair despite that. He was. I've just given you two examples of some of the women that he had relationships with, but there were many, many more.
Yeah, he definitely did seem quite prolific in his affairs. Something that I wanted to know a bit more about is when Aisha was when she accepted Jai's proposal, what would life look like for her as the third wife of a Maharaja? What could she expect?
Yeah, well, she would expect something completely different than, from the life that she'd been brought up in. Her mother, Indira Devi, was, as I mentioned earlier on, was came from Baroda. And Baroda was probably the most progressive of the princely states, followed closely by Cooch Behar. Now, her mother was had been betrothed to the Maharaja of Gwalior, one of the other major princely states. But she instead fell in love with a prince called Prince Jagadipendra, who was known as Jit, and who was, at the time when they fell in love, the third in line to the Cooch Behar throne. So Aisha's mother, Indira Devi, defied her parents' wishes and eloped essentially with Jit. They got married in England and she went to Cooch Behar to live and had five children. Aisha was her fourth. Now, Aisha was brought up, in total freedom. There was no purdah. You know, she used to laugh at the fact that she was brought up like a tomboy. She shot her first panther, I think, when she was about 11 years old. Indira found herself the regent of Cooch Behar when Jit died prematurely, like all other rulers of Cooch Behar, of alcohol-related illnesses. This book charts two tragedies, really. When it comes to Cooch Behar, they drank themselves to death. When it comes to Jaipur, they essentially drowned themselves in litigation. But Indira, her mother, found herself regent of Cooch Behar, frustrated the British no end by spending months and months at a time on the continent, again, gambling in the casinos of France, riding horses in Melton Mowbray and having numerous affairs herself. But Aisha grew up in this very liberal environment. She also went to school in Switzerland. She spent a long time in Europe. And so she knew what she was getting into. Jaipur was a very traditional state, and she knew that when she got there, she would have to go into purdah. And she accepted this. I don't think she really thought it through, because I think she expected Jai to, be a little bit more lenient with her, that she wouldn't be confined to the zenana, that she wouldn't be traveling around in a car with curtains so that members of the public couldn't see her, and so on. And after their marriage, she found it very, very difficult. Jai even forbade her to learn Hindi, which was the only language that most of the women in the zenana could speak, in case she got caught up in the various intrigues that were part and parcel of life in the zenana. She certainly wasn't prepared for the strictures of purdah after their marriage. And it took her a long time. And it is a testimony to her fiercely independent spirit that she gradually overcame the pressures that were placed upon her to conform to the traditions of Rajput society. One of the first things she did was to open a school for girls. These were daughters of the nobility, and she thought that only by education would she be able to set an example and free the other women of Jaipur, and we're talking about really the aristocracy again from the strictures of purdah. She plunged into the war effort, because these were the war years. raising money for British troops. She accompanied Jai, who was sent to the northwest frontier to fight up there. She eventually started taking up other causes for that were related to women, aside from education, teaching them skills. She got herself involved in sport and sporting associations and so on. So she really worked hard to create a space for herself and for other women in Rajasthan. And it's probably what she's best remembered for today as well.
And why do you think that they're seen as India's golden couple?
Well, Jai was, the star, handsome, very personable, star polo player. Aisha was considered one of the most beautiful women in the world. She was liberated. She had an incredible fashion sense, much of which she inherited from her mother. They mixed easily with, the smart set in America, in England, in Europe. They were invited to all the parties. They were friends with the Windsors. They were friends with JFK and Jackie. They were, their best friends were members of Europe's old aristocracy. They really, India needed a golden couple at the time as well, and they really lived up to people's fantasies as to what Indian royalty could be, if you like. Jai, every time they would spend every single Indian summer in Europe or on the continent. Jai, so he could play polo. Aisha, was always there watching him play, was also, doing her own socializing. Almost for half the year they were outside of Jaipur, and they had plenty of time to make friends who they would then invite back to India, put them up in their extraordinary palaces, take them for tiger shoots. And here again, we have Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip coming in 1961, on an official tour of India. But all the publicity that they got was from their trip to Jaipur, where the Queen was seated on an elephant and taken up to Amber Palace, where they went tiger shooting, which was a little bit controversial because Prince Philip shot a very large tiger, and when a picture of the hunting party and this poor tiger was splashed over the front pages of British newspapers, it caused quite a bit of controversy. But that was their lives. That was that they were the sorts of people that they mixed with. That was the sort of publicity that followed them around. That was the aura that they created. It was, and they far outshone any of the other Indian royals in that respect as well. They were just simply the best known Indian royal couple in the world.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Aisha was not in the first wave that was arrested, but she eventually did find herself in Tihar Jail, which is the main jail in Delhi, and conditions were tough.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster.
And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And thinking now about politics, so their lives are marked by extraordinary change. There's independence and partition in 1947. And I was really interested to know how their lives did change post-independence and what the role was for the princely states.
Yeah, well, getting the princely states to accede to the Indian Union was a mammoth exercise. You had, as I said, 560 odd states, and they basically all had to sign instruments of accession, either to join India or to join Pakistan. And only three in the end didn't: Hyderabad, Kashmir, and a small state called Junagadh in Gujarat. They were promised that after independence, they would retain. After India's independence, that they would retain their autonomy in all areas except for defence, communications, and foreign affairs. And they were also promised these, you know, the various rights which they were able to keep their titles. They could still be a Maharaja or a Raja or a Nizam or a Nawab or whatever. They could still import their Rolls Royces. And they also were promised privy purses, so an annual allowance, which ranged from, I think the smallest amount was maybe £20 up to a couple of hundred thousand pounds for some of the larger states like Jaipur. But very quickly, and some of the bigger states like Jaipur were told that they would remain as independent units as well, because they were considered viable. They were big enough for that. But within a few years, aside from the privy purses and keeping their titles and a couple of other perks, all that they'd been promised was gradually whittled away. They were incorporated into the Indian Union. Jaipur became part of the greater state of Rajasthan, along with the other states that had previously made up Rajputana, as it was known before independence. Jai had been made Raj Pramukh, which was kind of like a special office, like a governor. He was made governor of Rajasthan, but that was taken away from him as well. And then gradually, you had in India a socialist government under Jawaharlal Nehru, and to have these princes enjoying these perks, still getting their privy purses, was an anachronism, really. So the pressure was on Nehru and then his daughter Indira Gandhi to abolish these titles. The other thing that really irked Nehru, who never liked the princes at all, and did nothing to hide his abhorrence of them and their feudal ways. The other thing that irked him was the fact that a number of these princes started to enter politics and in opposition to Congress. And whenever they ran for election, they tended to win. And this is precisely what Aisha did in 1962. So shortly after Prince Philip and Queen Elizabeth left India. She announced that she was joining the Swatantra Party, which was like a free market liberal party, which became the main opposition party to Congress, and ran in the 1962 general election for the Lok Sabha for the federal seat of Jaipur. She won hands down. The margin of her electoral victory made the Guinness Book of Records. All 10 of her opponents had to forfeit their deposits. And this was, and Aisha at the time, she spoke no Hindi, which was the main language in Rajasthan. Whenever she was addressing election rallies, she would read from prepared speeches in a very sort of, accented Hindi, not particularly fluent. Bengali was her mother tongue. She could speak French better than she could speak Hindi. But yet, that royal aura managed to, was what got her through. And she stood for election 3 times at a federal level, and a couple of times at a state level, won all the national elections that she stood for. And, together with other princes as well, together with other members of India's royalty, for Nehru and then for Indira Gandhi, who were both that sort of post-independence euphoria had worn off. India was having problems on an economic front. It had fought a border war with China. There was all sorts of other things happening, and the Congress was losing its sheen. But the princes were shining light, if you like, and the voters just flocked to them in most cases, whatever they ran.
I also wanted to know a bit more about one aspect of Aisha's political career, which is when she's imprisoned by Indira Gandhi in 1977. Why is that?
It was said that Indira couldn't stomach Aisha because she was such a beautiful woman. And it said that their animosity went back to when they were at school together in Shantiniketan, which was a town in West Bengal. It was a university town set up by Rabindranath Tagore. They weren't at school together for a very long time, Aisha, the tomboy, he went around wearing slacks and would be, always having a cigarette, behind the toilet block, and she was sort of the naughty one, whereas Indira was dowdy couldn't enjoy that sort of freedom because she was the daughter of the Prime Minister of India. So it's said that the animosity between the two women went back to their school days, but certainly increased after Nehru died in 1964 and Indira Gandhi took over as Prime Minister in 1967. So from then on, a couple of instances I've referred to in the book of Indira Gandhi addressing election rallies in Jaipur, asking voters, what have the princes really done for you? I mean, she thought that these were still these throwbacks to feudal times. These were these autocratic rulers who hadn't really changed their mindset at all. That Congress was the party that was really represented them, and not these royals. When Indira Gandhi declared the emergency in 1975, all of her political opponents were rounded up essentially and thrown into jail, as well as critics of the government, journalists, trade unionists, and so on. Aisha was not in the first wave that was arrested, but she eventually did find herself in Tihar Jail, which was the main jail in Delhi, and conditions were tough. She had to share a room with another woman who there was only one bed. This woman slept on the veranda while Aisha enjoyed, you know, was given the bed. Eventually, she got her own room, but conditions were tough. I mean, there was hygiene was minimal at the very best. The jail was full of women who'd been thrown in there for prostitution and other things. It was a pretty rough place to be in, even though quite a number of the prisoners by then were political prisoners. But essentially, they were the bulk of them were still, you know, women who'd been thrown in for some on criminal charges, and many of them had been there for years and somebody left there and forgotten. So it was a tough time for her. And her family started lobbying Mountbatten, started lobbying, you know, the Queen, you know, to get her released. Stepson, who was the then Maharaja of Jaipur, Bhawani Singh, Bubbles as he was known, was also placed under arrest. So she endured, you know, a pretty tough prison regime and didn't cope well. There were other royals who were also placed in jail and seemed to have done much better, but she had health problems. I think it was just, you know, a shock to her to be in that sort of environment, and she did not cope well, and eventually was released before the emergency was over, but had to promise Indira Gandhi that she wouldn't engage in politics again. So that was a real climb down for her.
And you mentioned earlier in our conversation that Jai died in 1970. What impact did his death have on the family?
Well, Jai was the glue that kept that family together. So what we let's think of that family tree again. He had three wives, so there were three branches of the family. There was the main branch, and after his death, his eldest son, Bhawani Singh, who became known as Bubbles, became the Maharaja. You had a second branch of the family, Jodidi's sons, Pat and Joey. Again, lots of nicknames here, but Jai Singh and Prithvi Raj. And then you had a third branch of the family. Jai and Aisha had only one son, Jagat. And up until Jai's death, and for a while afterwards as well, the family stuck together as a unit. When Aisha and Bubbles were imprisoned in Tihar jail, the rest of the family, you know, pulled together and lobbied various people to try and get them out and so on. But within about 4 or 5 years of that, the family just started to split. And the first thing that, the first rift in this extended family occurred when Bubbles, who was the Maharaja, see, what happened was Jai, when he died, of course, left this vast estate. The wealth, hard to quantify. There were palaces, there were manor houses, there was a huge amount of gold, jewelry, ancestral jewelry. There were trust accounts where money had been placed and so on. Traditionally, the eldest son would inherit his father's estate. But in modern India, an act had been passed in the 1960s called the Hindu Undivided Family Act. And this meant that any inheritance would be distributed equally among all offspring. So this was a sort of egalitarian move, you know, and you know, a very, very fair one as well. But did it apply to the royal families? Did it apply to Jaipur? Now, that's a court case that is still ongoing, if you can believe it, 30, 40 years onwards. And then other court cases erupted. So basically, I mean, there were all these properties, some of which had been turned into hotels. There were shares in these companies that controlled the hotels. And again, litigation erupted over how these shares had been divided, that there were shares that were sort of mysteriously being transferred from one part of the family, from one branch of the family to the other. The sheer amount of litigation is extraordinary. In the 1990s, according to one estimate, there were 40 cases current in the courts in Jaipur to do with wills, to do with shares, to do with properties, to do with various other trusts and so on. And it was just something which just started to tear the family apart. Suddenly you had three branches of the family at loggerheads with one another. Sometimes there was two branches of the family at loggerheads with the third, and sometimes, you know, one of those branches would team up with the third branch to be at loggerheads with the remaining branch of the family. And this just consumed the family to even to the extent where you know, Jai and Aisha's only son, Jagat, was you know, even to the point where he at one point disowned his own children in a will that was allegedly forged, but still it was considered valid enough for the courts to take notice of it. And these things are still ongoing. It's quite extraordinary. Other royal families in India have managed to bury the differences, come to compromises, and you know, and divide assets, you know, accordingly. But the Jaipur family just does not seem to be able to do this. It's just too entrenched.
And for my final question, Aisha died in 2009. How is she remembered today?
Look, she was a complex character. You know, a person who wouldn't suffer fools lightly. She was entitled, opinionated, certainly. But you know, I think that's just one side of a character. But in general, by the vast majority of people, she's seen as a role model for women in India. As I mentioned, she devoted so much energy for women's education. She started a couple of schools. She started welfare projects for women. She plunged into politics. She made a successful career as a politician, which was no mean feat in those days, winning, as I said, three elections. You know, after her husband died in 1970s, so that, you know, when she was you know, quite an early age for her, she would have been just in her 40s. You know, she. You know, normally in Indian society, widows go into seclusion. They wear nothing but white and they withdraw from society. Her mother didn't do that. Indira Devi, as I said, she became regent of her state. And Aisha was not going to do that either. So she plunged even more energetically into her various projects, whether it was fighting for the preservation of Jaipur's heritage, promoting arts and crafts in the city, all these things. I mean, she was always passionate about polo, supported polo, supported other sporting initiatives. She kept traveling to Europe until, you know, the year before she died. She would make her annual pilgrimage to London. So she was, you know, she was a remarkable woman, and people remember her for that. But you know, it's a funny thing, Jaipur being Jaipur. If you go to the City Palace now, you won't find a single photograph of hers, you know, in the museum collection, which is again a reflection of you know, just how, you know, these decades now of litigation. I mean, it's now, I think it's the third generation of Jaipur royals that are fighting some of these cases, have had an, you know, this very detrimental effect on Jaipur's legacy. There's so much that it could be proud of, yet this litigation is just sullying the whole thing. And the fact that, you know, someone like Aisha, who did so much for her state and is, you know, so admired, you know, is almost been erased from the official history of Jaipur is a real tragedy. It's very sad. I think that people in Jaipur just wish that the various branches of the family would come to some sort of compromise, end decades of litigation, and be able to take pride in what not just Aisha but other members of the family, what this great dynasty, which is, you know, goes back 1,000 years, has achieved.
That was John Zabriskie. His book, The House of Jaipur, The Inside Story of India's Most Glamorous Royal Family, is on sale now, published by Seahurst & Co. You can find a link in the show notes. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman and Brittany Colley. Join us again on Friday when I'll be speaking to Lucy Bland about the babies fathered by African-American GIs in wartime Britain.